Okay, good morning, everyone. Boker Tov. So, we've been talking over the long arc about the role of Masorah, and now we're talking about transitioning to specific people who represent and shape our Masorah. So, to do that, last week we talked about how the Masorah can kind of branch out. You know, you can have Rab Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik, who has descendants who reflect different positions among the Baalei HaMasorah and within the general framework of the Masorah. So then what I think we really need to talk about is, why do we need these people, these Baalei HaMasorah, these particular individuals in any given generation and in our community? Why is that important to have? Why is it, you know, necessary to keep looking at the development? And so I was thinking about this from kind of different ways, and I reached out to a bunch of friends and colleagues and mentors of mine, and different people sent me different ideas, because it's a difficult thing to kind of put your finger on. I was looking for sources, classical makoros, and ideas that would concretize the importance. Why is it significant that we're going to spend a period of time looking at and developing the thought and the ideas, let's say specifically, primarily Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik? Well, why are they important figures? Why is that important in terms of the development of the Masorah for us? Why don't we just say, let's look in the Gemara, or let's find some ideas in the Rishonim? You know, what is it about, and what we could call on a colloquial basis, we can call Gedolim, great people. You know, why is that important? Why should that be important to us? How do I identify those people? So how do we identify those people? We'll touch on just a little bit at the end. But the real question is, you know, what is our relationship to that idea? Why is that important? And how does it fit in to the concept of Masorah? So among the different people who I asked, I got different ideas, and Makoros and pointed me in different directions. And then one person just said, oh, Rav Lichtenstein has an article. So in the second volume of Rav Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh Levracha, Leaves of Faith, the Jewish World, the World of Jewish Living, Rav Lichtenstein has a piece, it's chapter 14, called Legitimization of Modernity, Classical and Contemporary. And this was originally a paper that Rav Lichtenstein delivered in 1993 at a group called the Orthodox Forum, which is convened by Yeshiva University. And this article is awesome. So what we're going to do now is a bit of a crime, because we're going to try to translate Rav Lichtenstein's words, of which I did get, I would say, at least 75% of the English translation of the English words on my own. The rest, you need your own Google Translate or dictionary or thesaurus.
You sold dictionaries on the side.
Yeah. It is an incredible piece, and I hope that I'm not looking down at what's about to happen and thinking, wow, that's a pathetic travesty. But I want to use this article because he covers so much of the relevant topics that we need to think about, and go through some of the sources that he quotes and references, see them inside so we can understand what he's building, and then appreciate that for ourselves, and kind of setting the table for thinking about the Gedolim and the role that these great people play in our Masorah. So I think maybe the first place to start, which Rav Lichtenstein, Dave, why don't you come to this side? Rav Lichtenstein doesn't allude to this, and not everything we're going to say here appears in this article, but a lot of these ideas appear in the article, and you can check it out further on your own. But I want to start, actually, in terms of thinking about why we need someone to look to. I want to start by thinking about different aspects of Masorah that we as a community share, and different pieces of our Torah identity, and why looking to and contemplating the Baalei HaMasorah, these giant figures, these important people, is really significant. Now, one aspect of that we need to think about is that part of what defines us is that we have a complex worldview. You know, Dr. Schneer Lyman has an article, a very lengthy article, about Torah and, you know, Torah and Derech Eretz, Torah and, you know, fill in the blank. So he develops the historical perspective of the students of the Vilna Gaon, the founders of the Volozhin Yeshiva, and he points out that even the Vilna Gaon wasn't Torah only, but there is a spectrum of, you know, primarily Torah or Torah only, and then there's Torah and a little bit of secular studies, and then there's Torah viewing secular studies in, you know, in another light. When you start talking about, you know, Torah and, or the role of art, or the role of humanities, you have a complex picture that incorporates two different elements. One element is Kodesh, one is inherently spiritually valuable, and the other one is not inherently spiritually valuable, but as part of a person's spiritual makeup, may play a role in the development of someone's spirituality in different ways. So, for example, one of the Talmidim of the Gra, of the Vilna Gaon, talks about the spiritual value of music in the world of the Vilna Gaon, specifically because the Vilna Gaon was an expert in Kabbalah, in addition to everything else. And in the world of Kabbalah, music plays a role. So you can find now elements, importance to music, but music inherently doesn't necessarily have an intrinsically Torah definition. And so we have to be careful, because if you're going to incorporate music into your Torah worldview, well, are you using the Torah as the platform or as the lens through which you're incorporating music? Or by virtue of the fact that you've stepped outside the Dalet Amos, the four cubits of Halacha or the Beis Medrash, are you just kind of being co-opted by another, whether it's another religious worldview or a secular worldview? You know, once you take that step, you have to always be asking yourself, what's the motivation here? Why am I studying this? Why is this a part of my life? Is it just because everybody else is doing it? Well, if just because everybody else is doing it, that actually could be some kind of a spiritual cesspool. It could be a pothole that's dangerous. So maybe one reason that especially for our community, it's important to look to great figures to lead the way for us is because we're navigating a very complex world. Whether that world includes academic Torah study, whether it includes issues that relate to modern sociological phenomena, like socialism or feminism, what about issues of, you know, secular studies and other kinds of things that are outside, I don't know, humanism is another good example. So once you're asking these questions, we need to constantly keep in check as to what's being filtered in as authentic Torah, viewing the outside world through that prism, versus just kind of like a potpourri of whatever we're interested in that then comprises our quote-unquote hashkafa or our outlook, which is actually not religious or Torah-based or part of the Masorah at all, right? If the whole theme that we're developing this year is the importance of Masorah, well then, if we don't have arbiters of Masorah, then you could just, you know, make some kind of composite of various values and say, oh, that's also what we stand for. So having a person or a set of people who are shepherds and stewards of the Masorah to guide us in filtering and in calibrating what is a true inherent Torah value, where do we find that Torah value, how do we express it, so that's going to be very important for us. You know, in a certain sense, it's even more important than in communities where, you know, the vernacular and then the contemporary scene, they put a great emphasis on gedolim. But if you're in a community where we constantly need to be checking these things and figuring out what is appropriate, what is authentic, and what is foreign, so then the role of great people, as quote-unquote, is what Chazal would say, Eine Ha'eda, eyes of the generation, is going to take on greater significance. That's one aspect. Another aspect, which is much more general, relates to this first letter that I have here from Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. This was a piece, this appears in a collection of English letters, an English collection of letters called Community, Covenant, and Commitment. And this was originally a newspaper article in the 1950s where Rav Soloveitchik, who was an extremely delicate personality when it came to interpersonal relationships and respect for others, and he writes how in a different letter how he's not a preacher and he's not meant to convert other people, he has a very strongly worded, strident definition of what is Orthodox Judaism. And this is something that we need to keep coming back to and reinforcing for ourselves to understand what that is, because that question and that definition is constantly changing. And today it's probably changing, and is not changing, but is being challenged. And the contours and the boundaries of that are being navigated all the time. So he says, on the one hand, on the right side, he says, number one, first one must be a lamdan, a scholar. Just as one who speaks about mathematics or physics must have a thorough knowledge of his field, so must one first know the halacha in order to be able to discuss its problem. But lamdanos cannot be achieved without study, nor by the process of divine revelation. One must sacrifice many years of study of halacha in order to understand it. So the first thing is, you know, if you have an enterprise that is very weak in the area of actual investment in lamdas and in knowledge, so then that doesn't pass muster for the first of the litmus tests. It just doesn't exist. You don't get to first base. Number two, secondly, one must unconditionally accept the sacredness of the halacha and its eternal and absolute character. One must confess that it obligates everyone to realize its demands in all times and under all conditions, social, political, or cultural. And you can't just say, says Rav Soloveitchik, you know, I like clapping homam, that's good. Fasting on Tisha B'Av, not my thing. Right? That's not acceptable. So for our community, we have to remind ourselves that just because we like to affiliate with Orthodoxy, we could be socially Orthodox, but that's not Orthodox. Orthodox means we have to be fully committed. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to be perfect. Ain't tzadik baretz asher yaaseh tov v'lo yechta. But in terms of how we define ourselves and how we establish our goals for our life, it's not, there's no compromise here. It's not a watered-down version of some Judaism. It is a full and firm, all-encompassing commitment. It's the equivalent of somebody who comes to convert, so to speak, and Iker Tzedek has to accept every single din. If the person says, I'm going to accept every single din, except one, they can't become a part of the Jewish people. Wait a second, when they accept all the mitzvahs upon themselves, the first week, they're probably going to violate half of them because they don't even know all the halachas. You only learn as you go along. But the point is not how much you know, it's how much you're committed to. Right? If we're fully committed, then we're fully committed and we're going to learn and we're going to grow. That's part of life. But thirdly, the interpretation of halacha must be accomplished in accordance with the methods, principles, and categorical forms of the halachic logic, which were hammered out by the sages of the Torah, Rishonim, early rabbinic period, and Achronim, late rabbinic period, Rashi, the Tosfos, Ramban, the Shach, Rabbi Kiva Eger, Rabbi Chaim Brisker, etc. The substance of the, turn the page, of the halacha is tradition. Masorah. Not only the content and the text, but also the formal instruments of halachic thinking have been handed down from generation to generation. That's number three, the methodology of halacha. So anybody who is serious and knowledgeable about the world of Torah and the world of halacha knows that throughout the generations there have been people, whether they were the formal Baalei HaMasorah that the Rambam identified, or people who were treated, who were viewed and venerated as Baalei HaMasorah of that generation, and they were given and they were accorded that status. Now, we're not discussing today another topic, which would be an interesting topic to talk about in this context of how to stratify, meaning the Gemara has an expression that Ravina Ravashi Sof Hora, Ravina and Ravashi, who edited the Talmud, they're the end of Talmudic period. So that means that you can't argue if you're, you know, you can't wake up today and argue on the Talmudic period. There's a question, well, what happens after that? Can the Rambam living in the 12th century argue on one of the Gaonim arguing in the living in the 10th century, let's say. So that's an interesting discussion back and forth. But what is the underlying assumption is that there are in every generation great lights that illuminate the landscape, the scene. If you ask the Shulchan Aruch, how does he paskin the Shiloh? How does he decide? You know, there are so many opinions. The reason that he wrote the Shulchan Aruch was because he's like, you ask the average person, go read a Gemara and tell me what the Psak Halacha is after you finish reading the Rif and the Rambam and the Rosh and the Ran and the Ritva and the Rashba. Everybody, you couldn't get to first base. He says, let me simplify it. So he says, I'll tell you how I'm going to simplify it. He writes this in his Hakdama to the Beis Yosef. He says, I'm going to look at three primary pillars, the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh. And we'll go with two out of three, Acharei Rabbi Mahatos, which is how you follow the majority. Whatever the two of them say, that's what we're going to go with. Now, of course, in the case of the Beis Yosef, he stacked the deck because the Rif and the Rambam are both Sephardic, and the Rosh is primarily from the Shorish of Ashkenaz, so the Sephardic tradition is going to win out. So for the Beis Yosef, the Sephardic tradition is usually going to carry the day. But the point is that it's not that every Chacham in the period of the Spanish Rishonim, everybody's entitled to an opinion. Everybody's opinion is treated with the same weight. Of course not. Part of the definition of tradition and Masorah is identifying who are the greats in any given generation, and then those opinions are weighted in accordance with their greatness. You know, nobody could confuse the Rambam with some other, you know, local rabbi who was dutifully serving his congregation in Spain or in France or wherever he was in the 12th century. So this is important in every generation, not because it's a legal construct, so to speak, today, the same way that it was in the time of the Gemara, but the concept of halacha being transmitted and the idea that the Torah in every generation is guided by a certain set of methodology and halachic tools. Well, one of those tools has to be looking to the great people of the generation. It goes back to the first criteria of Lamdus. And there are people who devote their life wholly and exclusively or primarily or, you know, essentially to Talmud Torah. Look at Rav Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who wrote and spoke about how, yes, he had a PhD from Harvard in literature and included and encompassed everything, you know, out there of good, of culture, although his wife last year pointed out, right in this very room, Dr. Lichtenstein pointed out that culture for Rav Lichtenstein was a very refined matter. It wasn't just whatever, you know, here comes the bride. Remember, that was the story that she told, that they left Chicago because they went to a Jewish wedding and they played Here Comes the Bride. She said, here comes the bride, that's not culture. My husband wouldn't have agreed with that. And then she added, kind of half-jokingly, that that's why my husband hasn't read anything since the 18th century or something like that. But the point is that even Rav Lichtenstein, who was extremely broad in terms of his scope and his perspective on the world, he said that his life was the Dalai Lama Shel Halacha, and everything was filtered through that, and everything was kind of packaged and calibrated around that. That was what he spent the bulk of his time doing. You know, I asked Dr. Lichtenstein, she should live and be well when she was here, I asked her about her father and her husband, what that was like and how they were able to do all the things that they did. She said, well, one of the things was it was very simple. They just sat for hours and hours and learned. She said, my father would close the door, my husband would close the door and just learn for many, many hours uninterrupted. That's just what it was. That's it. So when I was in Rav Lichtenstein Shir in Grus, you know, these Mar Makomos that he gave us, I think I had heard of all the Rishonim that he quoted there. I think I knew that they existed. But his grasp of the breadth of Torah was astonishing. So that piece of defining halacha is very important. So for us, we need in every generation to continue this Masorah of the halachic process, we need that component of the Masorah.
Don't you have an issue where essentially each community picks its own people to designate as those people who you're going to call the greatest in that generation and follow and say, okay, these are the ones, these are not the ones, and then you end up with, you know, 16 different versions.
Excellent. So we could stop this year right now and just we'll take that, or we could develop that idea more. Exactly, because last week, this is exactly the point that we're trying to develop, which is that last week we showed that Reb Lezer and Yeshua had different approaches. Okay, so that different approach comes about. Well, now we need to figure out how that's going to develop Lacha L'maaseh, so to speak, practically among different communities. And that's what we're going to get to. That's going to be the ultimate goal, is to see how we can have these different Masoros and how these different Balei HaMasora will attract or create the different channels, I guess you could call them. Rav Lichtenstein, Zichrono Livracha, would probably say, Arutzim Shonim. You know, different channels within the Masorah. Exactly that point, which is what he himself is going to develop. I put that at the end. Someone else had a hand on this side. Yeah, Barbara.
I was just going to say how, but as much as it's based in halakha and, you know, the basic tenets of halakha, and it's just changed, like, almost according to, I don't want to say the times, because it hasn't changed according to the times, but then again, there's been modifications. And so who's to say what the modification, if that is the right approach? I don't
Great.
Think that's yes. the proper way to say it. I don't want to be disrespectful of that, but I just see that there are so many things that, according to halakha, look, it used to be that men could have more than one wife, and now, of course, now they can't. But I can't help but think of the whole aguna issue, that somehow things have changed, but that hasn't.
So
and I don't understand how.
So that's exactly what I want to address, which is the answer to that question is that it's a partnership between the community and the great sages of every generation. And what I wanted to focus on today is the second half of that, which is we as a community can sit around and come up with solutions, but if those solutions aren't endorsed by the great rabbinic leadership, then we don't have standing. And that's why, in the cases examples as you have brought, over centuries and generations, the goal of rabbinic leadership has been to address, in the context of halacha, all of the needs, dating back even to the times of Hillel, when they saw that there was an economic freeze with the onset, you know, of the close period, I don't know how many years it was, maybe a year before Shemitah, people stopped, nobody was going to lend any money, so they instituted Prizbol, and then when Rabbeinu Gershom in the, you know, around the year 980 or so, whatever the year exactly was, we don't know exactly when he promulgated his Cherem, we know he had a bunch of them, so he said you can't marry more than one wife, and then in today's example, for example, let's say many senior important rabbinic figures have spent countless hours working on the aguna problem. So let's say you had a couple who was getting married, for example, and somebody was going to do that wedding. So they would know that the rabbinic leaders of the generation say, we have a document, it's called the RCA prenup, that we as senior rabbinic colleagues have gotten together and wrote, and this is going to be the simplest answer to the aguna problem. So if you are a rabbi in a community, you should call your local gadol, your important person who you look to, and ask them about the prenup. So the Mai Rabbeim would say, you can't do a wedding without a prenup. I wouldn't have a havamina to do a wedding for a couple without a prenup. And that is the way that contemporary gadolim, giants, are going to look at different problems in every generation. So my question is, what we want to explore today is, why do we need the great giants of the generation? Why don't we just kind of make it up as we go along? And in today's time, this question is more important than ever. Because today, everybody's got an answer, because you have Google. I've told this story before, you're probably tired of hearing it, but when Dr. Schneer Lyman was the Scholar Residence in Or Torah the last time, I don't remember how many years ago it was a couple years ago, so we had the privilege, because he's a cousin of ours, he ate at our house Shabbos lunch, and he said to us at the table, he said, today we need graduate schools more than ever, you know, because he teaches in a graduate school, he needs a parnasa. So I said, why do you say that today we need graduate school? He wasn't talking Jewishly, really. He was talking in general, but of course he was talking Jewishly. He says, you know why? He says, because today there is a glut of information out there. He says, what you learn in graduate school is not more information. He says, you learn tools of analysis. And you learn how to discern and sift through the information that you're given. and how you put it together. You learn a methodology. So today, with the glut of information, we need more emphasis on how to weigh and measure, because today you can Google any question and you get tons of information. But who says that that information that you're getting is authoritative and meaningful? You know, you listen to the news sometimes, you hear discussions, and you can't, because of the nature of the internet with its many blessings, you can't get rid of certain things. They're talking still about shots and vaccinations. They're still going back to the same discredited research that you can't expunge from the internet. So, on this point, in a certain sense, talking about the role of great people in a generation, identifying who they are and understanding their significance, takes on even more weight today. You know, but, on the other hand, does that mean that the community has no role and abrogates? No. The Rambam tells us that if the sages of the generation get together and they want to enact a resolution that won't be sustainable by most people, even if they try, the resolution that they have is not binding. It's gzeira she'enach atzibur yicholim lamod bo. Even if they institute it, the Rambam says, they can stand up and vote that that's the takana, it's not binding. Because there has to be buy-in, there has to be a role that the community is going to play. So obviously we have to be able to uphold the standard, but the point that I want to think about today is, so what is the role of these chachamim, and why do we need them in every generation? Why is it important that they have a seat, or the seat, arguably, at this table? So the first place to look is on page number 3, which is kind of the general beginning, the beginning of Parashas Shoftim, that tells us that the Sanhedrin, that if you have a question, you go to the Sanhedrin in the Lishkas HaGazis, and we once talked about how the Gemara in Sanhedrin describes that you go up to Yerushalayim, and you meet the next person, and the next person, remember this hierarchy. And according to the Torah that they tell you, you should follow it. Top right, this is in the beginning of Parsha Shoftim. What does the second half of the pasuk say? Lo sasur, do not stray min hadavar from the thing asher yagidu lecha yamin u'smol, from the thing that they tell you, right or left. You have to follow what the rabbis of the Bez and Hagadol tell you. And this chumash that I copied for you is called the Torah Tumima. The Torah Tumima, Rav Baruch HaLevi Epstein, about 100 years ago, he was related to the Netziv. He and the Aruch HaShulchan, he collects kind of a potpourri of Ma'amari Chazal, Gemaras, Yerushalmis, that are on each pasuk, and he puts them for you. So on this pasuk, Lo Sasur, you see at the bottom of the top section on page 3, Lo Sasur, Kol Mili Derabbanan, all rabbinic statements, Asmechu Chachamim Alav de Lo Sasur. They hung their hat, the rabbis, on the prohibition of Lo Sasur. This then becomes the machlokas of the Rambam and the Ramban about the nature of this prohibition. But what they're saying is essentially, every time you have a rabbinic requirement, for example, lighting Shabbos candles. So we know that there is a mitzvah of Zechiras Shabbos. We mentioned it yesterday in Haseres HaDibros, remembering Shabbos. So how do you fulfill the mitzvah of Zechiras Shabbos? So that's a good question. You know, you can mention Shabbos, you can mention Shabbos on Sunday. There's a lot of discussion about that. But there's nowhere in the Chumash that it says you have to light candles on Friday night. It doesn't actually say that anywhere in the Chumash. So we know that the mitzvah of Hadlakas Neres Shabbos, that is a din d'rabbanan, that's a rabbinic enactment. Okay, who says we have to listen to them? So in that context, we invoke the principle of Lo Sasur. The rabbis of the generation says you have to light Shabbos candles. So that's now a mitzvah. And it's a mitzvah d'rabbanan that you're going to light candles with a bracha. You're going to say Lahadlik Ner Shel Shabbos, even though it doesn't appear in the Chumash anywhere. So this is the first basic source that tells you have to listen to the Chachamim. They're going to be the arbiters of disputes, of interpretation, and even when it comes to Kol Mili d'rabbanan. And that's what the Torah Tumima quotes on the top of the next column. That's why you make the bracha of Lahadlik Ner Shel Chanukah. It doesn't say Chanukah anywhere in the Chumash either, but that's the source that Mark quotes in Shabbos and Chav Gimel. And then, look at the bottom, on the left-hand column, the bottom of the Torah Tumima, Yaminu Smol. Well, first he quotes the Yerushalmi in Horios. Let's do that one. Second to last one. Yochalim yomer l'chal yamin shu smol. What if the sages tell you the right is really the left, or the left is really the right? Tishma lahem, you should listen to them. Tamid lomar yaminu smol. Kishim yomer l'chal al yamin shu yamin. If they tell you the right is the right, va'al smol shu smol, on the left, that's the left. And the last quote is from a Sifri. Yaminu smol va'afilu nir be'enecha. Even it looks to you, al smol shu yamin, that the left is the right, va'al yamin shu smol, and the right that is the left, Shema Lahem, you should listen to them. Now, this is a much longer discussion than we have time for today, because if you look in the bottom of the Torah, to me, he quotes the Ramban seems to say that you have to listen to the Chachamim, even if you know that it's right, and they're saying it's left, which is a big discussion. This is like the Cain Mutiny question, which is not for today. But the point is, as a matter of principle, you might think that, you know, this is the best way to solve a problem. You might have a conundrum, you know, we have an issue that we need to figure out. You could think of the best solution. But if you go to the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin say, no, we have a better solution, you have to forfeit your opinion in face of the opinion, in the face of the opinion of the Sanhedrin.
You said that if a community doesn't hold by you, you accept what the community wants to
do. Oh, so that's exactly why we mentioned that it's a partnership. Meaning, the community can say, we can't withstand the intensity, let's say, of this decree. I'll give you an example. The Gemara says in Bava Basra, originally after the destruction of Beis Hamikdash, they said, look, we can't eat meat anymore. How can you eat meat if you don't have carbs? And the Gemara says, that wouldn't fly. Nobody would be able to withstand that. They couldn't withstand that. But when it comes to other kinds of questions, which don't rely on the community, but are more questions in this context of interpretation. You know, how do you define what is the malacha of boneh? How do you define what is the malacha of boneh? So the Sanhedrin get together and they say, you know, boneh means building, and that's going to include various things, you know, making them a composite. What about making cheese? Part of the process of making cheese, let's say you take a cheesecloth, you take a bunch of curds, you put them in a cloth, you squeeze it tightly together, you kind of press it together. So the Gemara in Shabbos says, well, you know, that's called megabain. Megabain comes from the word gavina, cheese. Cheese making on Shabbos, that's like boneh. That probably came to the Sanhedrin. Someone who probably said to the Sanhedrin, well, what about making cheese on Shabbos? By the way, as a nafgamina potentially for Yom Tov, can you make cheese on Yom Tov? But the point is that kind of a question, that doesn't have any, you know, that doesn't have any community buy-in. The Chacham are going to decide what it is. And so the question is, who do we have to listen to? Who says that you listen? The answer is, you have to listen to the Chacham of your Sanhedrin. Now, there is a further question as to whether or not this din of Lo Susser will apply today. Let's say you ask a Shaila of your posek, and he gives you an answer, and you decide you're going to ignore it. So is that a violation of Lo Susser? I can't say whether that is or that isn't, because there's a much longer conversation to be shown about the parameters of this point. But the idea is that in your generation, you have rabbis who are living in the Sanhedrin. They're sitting there in the Beis HaMikdash. They're going to decide this question, and we have to listen to them. So you might tell me, well, maybe that was then doesn't have any contemporary bearing. But look at this Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Chaf Hei Amud Aleph. Bottom of page 4. Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis learned. Lama lo nisparshu shmosam shal zekenim halalu. Why were the names of these elders not enumerated? Shalo yomar adam. Nobody should say, Ploni kemoshe va'aron. Ploni kenod va'aviyu. Ploni ke'eldar u'meidan. Wait a minute. I'm living in the times of Rav and Shmuel. Rav and Shmuel, these were the greatest of the greats of the Amoraic period. And somebody comes to the Beis Medrash and says, you know what? Rav and Shmuel, they're great. We love them. They're very nice and everything. But, you know, let's be honest. They're not Moshe and Aaron. They're not Eldon and Medon, who were prophets. You know, the Chazal venerate them. They weren't Nadav and Avihu, who also were great people. So why do I have to listen to them? You know, you had somebody wake up one day in Africa, North Africa, somewhere in the 12th century, early 13th century, says, you know, I heard this guy Maimonides, People are talking about him, but you know what? Even though they say, Mi Moshe ad Moshe lo kam ke Moshe, there was nobody from Moshe to Moshe, but let, you know, if that Moshe and this Moshe, not the same. Seriously. It's not the same. So the Gemara says, Va'omer, it says, Va'yomer Shmuel al ha'am asher asa, es Moshe ve'es Aaron va'omer va'yishlach Hashem es Yerubal ve'es Bedan ve'es Yiftach ve'es Shmuel. Yerubal ze Gidon, v'loma nikra Shmo Yerubal she'asa Mariva Mabal, Bedan ze Shimshon, v'loma nikra Shmo Shimshon, Shimlom, why is it called Bedan to asa Midan, Yiftach, top of the next page, va'omer Moshe va'aron b'cho'anov, u'shmuel b'korei Shmo. We say this every single Friday night from the Hail of David HaMelech from Tehillim. What does it mean, Moshe and Aaron and Shmuel? Shikel hakosav shlosha kali olam kishlosha chaburi olam. And I would never have the audacity, who the heck am I to say somebody is a kal, is a lightweight, but the Gemara says it. So I'm not disrespecting them, but the Gemara is disrespecting them. Gidon was not, he wasn't like a tremendous sage. He wasn't. The Gemara is calling him kali olam. I'm not, excuse my language. That's what it says. And yet, it says, Shikel, it equated, it weighs. Lo malacha to tell you, Yerubal bedoro, Kemosha bedoro. If you're in the generation of Gidon, you have to listen to Gidon like the people who listened to Moshe in his generation. Don't be a smart aleck and say, look at Gidon. He's not such a big Torah giant. I don't have to listen to him. You know what? In your generation, he's the top person. You have to listen to him. That's what the Gemara is telling you. And it's the concept of Lo Sasur, of this concept of rabbinic authority, that is going to carry over through the generations. Even if you look at a posik in a particular generation, you say, oh, you know, you remember when we had Rav Henkin, Zichrono Levracha, in America, when we had, you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein in America, Zichrono Levracha, we had Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, Zichrono Levracha. Oh, in those days we had poskim. Today we don't have any poskim anymore. No more. That's ridiculous. Every generation, we're honest. No one is saying that Rav Moshe was the same level of stature as the Chassam Sofer. He wasn't. And he would himself tell you that. But Rav Moshe writes in Hakdama to the Igros Moshe, he says, look, in certain cases, I'm going to argue with the Chassam Sofer. Because I'm going to do the best analysis that I can, and I'm Higia Lahora, so I have to say what I think is pshat. But it's okay that Rav Moshe was not at the same stature as the Vilna Gaon. That's okay. And so this idea of extending the influence of the Chachmei HaMesora continues even on page Lamed Gimel. Excuse me, on Daf Lamed Gimel here in Sanhedrin on page 6, where the Gemara tells us, Omrav Sheshes, what becomes halachic standard? Omrav Asi, Ta Bidvar Mishnah, if a rabbinic court makes a mistake in something which is academic, meaning it is accepted, standard psak. And that psak, if you make a mistake on that standard psak, your ruling is going to get overturned. What constitutes a standard psak? The Gemara says, Amalei Ravina l'Ravashi, afilu ta bidrabichi of Rabbi Oshia. Even if the Dayan, the judge, made a mistake in something that was taught by Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Oshia. Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Oshia, they were at the end of the Mishnaic period. They were the editors of the Braisa. Wait a minute, Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Oshia, they were not Hillel Hazakim. They're not like super elders. That's the previous generation. The Gemara is saying, even if you made a mistake in just one generation back, that accepted psak of the generation of Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Oshia, that's a mistake. Because their ruling is binding. The Gemara says, Amalei in. Yes. Amalei afil bit Rav and Shmuel, even Rav and Shmuel in their generation. Amalei in. Amalei afilu bit in. Afilu bididiu bididach, even in our generation. Is that also binding? Is that also a Torah standard? Is that also the Psak? Amalei atu anan. Are we katli kani ba'agma anan? We're just guys who hang around cutting reeds in the swamp? We also have great people in our generation. We also have Gedolim. We also have a standard of Psak. And that's got to be accepted. So the idea that it is essential as part of our halacha and our Masorah is that in every generation there are people who are going to set the standard of Psak for a community. And this could be a discussion more narrowly in a particular halachic question, like how to deal with an Aguna crisis, or hashkafically, how do we deal with technology? How do we view new trends in modernity? So it's going to be decided by the standard bearers, the gedolim of any generation. But at the same time, and this is what kind of David was alluding to before, once we have that person, we are going to follow that person in our community. And what do I mean by that? I mean by that two things. Number one, look in the Gemara and Daf Kuf Tezayin and Chulin. In the old days, if you had your Baal HaMasorah, if you had your Posek, and it exists that way in certain respects today too, B'mekomo shel Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer was of the opinion that on Yom Tov, well, actually, this is talking about Shabbos. He has an opinion about Yom Tov separately, but this is talking about Shabbos. On Shabbos, when you do a bris milah, you're not only allowed to do the bris, you're allowed to do all the ancillary melachos to set it up. You can build a fire to fashion a knife to sharpen so that you can perform the bris. You could have done it yesterday. Blaise says you could do it today.
But you can't carry the bag, the tools.
He says you can carry the bag too.
That's not what we do.
We don't do that. We follow Rabbi Akiva. So what is the Gemara telling us? B'makomo shel Rabbi Eliezer, in his neighborhood, they were allowed to follow him. So if you were, let's say, in your neighborhood, you would never, no one would ever see you carrying the bag to the bris. You carry it before Shabbos. But in Rabbi Eliezer's neighborhood, because they followed him, he was their Baal HaMasorah, they did it. And the Gemara says, B'makomo shel Rabbi Yossi Aglili, in Rabbi Yossi Aglili's place, because Rabbi Yossi Aglili held that there's no prohibition of eating chicken and milk together, even midrabanan. So Rabbi Yossi Aglili held that's mutter to eat, you know, a chicken mixed sandwich, whatever. So they did. B'mekomo, they actually did that. So if you have your Baal HaMasorah and it has not yet been outvoted as a communal consensus, so then you're entitled to your opinion as a Baal HaMasorah, and your students are going to follow you even if you're in the minority.
So what's a neighborhood here in the United States?
Bingo. Oh, amazing, amazing. So now, exactly. So now we're starting to get to the question that David alluded to, which is, wait a second. Now that we understand that we need Baalei HaMasorah, they are essential. You can't live a committed, observant, aspirational, rabbinic life, Torah lifestyle, without that. Well, how do you define that? So the answer is going to be, I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but we'll see it kind of developed in this Rashba, is that in a certain sense, that's what every person's personal choice is about. That today, especially, it's less about where you live geographically as much as it is where you live in terms of your connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in your neshama, in your spiritual community. You can have people who are Hasidim of Rav Nachman of Breslov, who died, remember, when Abraham Lincoln was 1 year old. Vic, you can have Breslov or Hasidim who live all over the world. And so in a certain respect, their connection to their Baal HaMasorah transcends both time and place. And then you can have people who connect on their level. They connect with, let's say, Rav Lichtenstein, Zichrono Livracha, and his whole outlook. He was, as in his own words, he would never say this about himself, he was an Ilan Gadol, as they would say in the Gemara, a great tree. So there are many people, myself included, who hold on to the branches of that tree. I don't live in Gush Etzion. But you notice over time, these communities kind of self-define. It becomes Bimkomo Shel Rebbe Lezer. It becomes Bimkomo Shel the Satmar Rav. Well, after the war, the Satmar Chassidus was decimated. They were tiny. They were nothing. My grandmother, Shalim Bewell, tells me she remembers when she would deliver Cholav Yisrael milk from their family farm outside of Scranton to New York to various Rebbes, to the Kapishnitzer Rebbe, to the Satmar Rebbe. She told me that once she went to deliver milk to the Satmar Rebbe and she passed a woman scrubbing the floors when she went to deliver the milk, and it turned out it was the Satmar Rebbetzin because they didn't have enough money to pay for a cleaning lady. And now the Satmar Chassidus is enormous. How did that happen? Because around the Satmar Chassidus kind of grew this community and it repopulated what was before the war. And the same thing in various different communities. Whether it's Chassidic or look what Rav Aaron Cutler came off a boat running away from Kletsk in Europe, and he rebuilt a whole community of adherents who follow in that Masorah. So that's exactly what we're talking about. That today, and Rav Lichtenstein is going to identify this, that today it's not necessarily going to be about geography as much as it's going to be about identification. And this is going to be important if we say we're not a compromising community. Once we decide we're going to commit to this Masorah, it's not kind of a pick and choose. Well, like we like this kula and we like that kula. The Gemara says if a person goes around cherry picking the kulas of Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, they're a Rasha. That's not acceptable. So this, I want you to see, of course, I'm running late. Go to page 8, because the Ramah here quotes a Tshuvas HaRashba. We're not going to see it inside, we're going to see the Rashba inside. The Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, is writing this Halacha L'maisa in Choshe Mishpat in Simen Chaf Hei, where if you have a minig in your city to be Mekah like your Chacham, then that's your approach. If your Chacham says that in today's day and age, we need to address the curriculum for our boys and our girls in a certain way, then that's the minig. That's the way that it is. What later Chacham comes, that's what the Ramah addresses in a second. But the idea that we have an identity and it is shaped and guided by great Baal Yom HaSorah that we hold on to, that's core to what we are. Take a look on the next page, on page 9. In my Tshuvas HaRashba, I couldn't find the right edition with the right page, so I had to give it to you from the Bar Ilan. The Rashba was basically asked this question. Umasha Amarta, Rav Shlomo ben Aderet, great, gaon, important Rishon, 14th century, Spain. Halacha l'maisa b'dvarim shim b'machlokas. What do you do if you have a machlokas? Bein chachmei poskim shezeh oser v'zeh matir. This one says it's oser and this one says it's mutter. This one says it's a mitzvah to serve in Sahal and this one says it's an iser to serve in Sahal. So what do you do? Nomar, can we say sometimes kedai hu ploni hameka lismach alav, that we can rely on the lenient opinion in certain cases? O nomar kevan sharav alfasi v'harambam zal, or maybe because the Rambam in the Rif shavin b'chol ladas achas zulos mekomos yesh no din, we always have to follow the universal psak of the Rambam and the Rif menachiv shenismach aleim ben lekulam ben lechuma v'lo nismach alacher. This was asked to the Rashba. This was exactly the question that he's dealing with. How do we decide the psak? There are so many opinions. So the Rashba, he kind of takes this in a couple of different pieces. So first of all, he says, in general, the concept of kedai hu, a certain person you can rely on in a lenient circumstance, that's only in a case of need. Okay, sometimes we'll say, oh, you have this, you know, unfortunately in Europe, we go back to this example many times, you have this case where family, they're mamish, they're poor, they don't have anything to eat, and they have one set of glasses for Pesach. So kedai hu, ploni, lismuch olav, you can rely on that shita about kashering your glasses for Pesach. You know, if a case where it's not a need, you can go to Ross, Amazing Savings, wherever, you buy a cheap pair set of glasses for Pesach, then you're not going to rely on that outlying shita, that minority shita. That's one piece that he addresses at the beginning. And then he talks about it. Go down, I should have numbered this, 1, 2, 3, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. 13 lines down, the first word in the word is haposkim. Four or five words in. Imnota ha'echad gadol b'chachma v'minyan. If you have one great gadol hador, who is outstanding, distinguished, you follow him in either way. In a case where you have two people who are equal, then it depends if it's midah or rais, you have to be stringent. If it's drabanan, you have to be lenient. Go three lines later, the beginning of the word is underline Hoshea. Avalim haya rav echad b'mekomam v'limdam hein hocham achar devarav. If you have a rabbi in your community, you follow the rabbi in your community. And he says, Vizel Chalukas Eretz Yisrael Ubavel Betarva. This is the difference between the people living in Israel, their one community. They follow, when it comes to certain chalev, certain trapering of the fat to get it out, they follow one opinion. But if you go to Bavel, they follow a different opinion. And then he quotes Argamar about Bimkomos or Ablezer. But what you see now is the Rashba is starting to expand it. He's starting to say it's not just if you have one rabbi in your neighborhood who's your posik, who's your gadol. That gadol influences all of Eretz Yisrael, meaning all of the people who follow, all of the community that associates and identifies with that gadol. And that is what Rav Lichtenstein points out on page 10, to kind of summarize where we've gotten to. So then it depends. If it's like kind of like a local halachic minute question about a machlokes, good. So that's a question where you have an issue of being Mishanim at Neha Machlokes, where if in one particular place everybody's doing one thing, you see this, let's say, a lot in Cholamoid with Tefillin. So today America is a melting pot, so they have all kinds of things how to do it. But in the old days, it would be a problem. It would be a problem of making a Machlokes. But today, the concept of going from one place to the other, you know, if you're going to come to a community, you're going to set up a school, the curriculum that you're going to set up, it's going to follow the curriculum of the Masorah, of your teachers, or your Rabbeim. And going back to Barbara's point from way earlier, it's not that the Torah is changing. The Torah gives you values A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And in every Chacham's mind, they're going to be calibrating those values. And so different posts are going to calibrate them differently. Good example of this, which is a very sensitive topic. Everybody, Halavai, all the singles, everybody should find a Shidduch. And all the Shidduchim should be Ola Yafe, and everybody should be blessed with children. That's not always the case. So in that context, sometimes the question comes up, something called contraception, birth control. Well, there you have varying halachic variables. You have economic considerations, potentially. You have psychological considerations. You have the mitzvah of Sheves, the mitzvah of Puravu. And how do you balance those? Well, different Chachmei HaMasorah, different poskim will balance those differently. They have the same values. Everyone agrees they have the same values. The question is how you weigh them and how you measure them. So who you follow is going to influence how that plays out. So take a look here. Look at what Rav Lichtenstein writes here. In page 10 on the left-hand side. In one sense, the position that I have outlined exalts authority and inhibits its autonomy, inasmuch as it posits sanctioned by a contemporary gadol as a condition for the halachic legitimacy of a movement. That's what I've been trying to say for the last 45 minutes. He says it in this article. He says it much better than I do. But we need, without that, says Rav Lichtenstein, we do not move. And yet, in another sense, it ultimately leaves the decision in the hands of the individual, as it is for him to choose in which camp to pitch his tent. The more modernist among us will probably be somewhat uncomfortable with the first proposition, but anyone who has discussed these issues with serious young B'nai Torah knows that they are more perturbed, actually, he says, more perturbed by the second. They are often doubly perplexed. First, they may be fazed practically or conceptually by the difficulty of making a choice. How does one know to whom to attach oneself? Second, they may be troubled ideologically by what is at once the prerogative and the burden. They recognize that in selecting a mentor to whom one will admittedly be bound, one is exercising an autonomous choice that will largely determine one's future agenda and priorities, so that a measure of personal freedom is definitive after all. Some are exhilarated, but others are taken aback, if not frightened. In response, I find myself telling them, in essence, that the second question answers the first. Obviously, one does not choose among gedolim by gauging respective degrees of lumdus or saintliness. One seeks a leader who, top in the next column, who speaks to one's own inner sanctum, as a convert to Hasidus would seek a Rebbe. The quest for a mentor is integrally and dialectically related to self-definition, a process to which conscience and sensibility are indeed crucial. Hence, as to the second question, it has no answer and needs no answer. Indeed, up to a certain point and beyond another point, one is charged with charting one's own course. But should this frighten or alarm? And what is the alternative? The fact that some are, in fact, alarmed is a reflection of the flight from spiritual responsibility endemic in certain circles. From a genuine Torah perspective, it can only be deemed regrettable. Says Rav Lichtenstein, it's amazing. It's like magic. It's unbelievable. So the point is, Rabosai, and I'm speaking to myself and everybody's listening, isn't this what our life is about? It's about going on a journey, And Rav Lichtenstein is reminding us that journey means how do we continuously take our Yiddishkeit more seriously? How do we integrate it more into our personality? How do we make that our life mission? How do we have that define us? And as part of that journey, we're going to seek out. You know, so part for me, this is such an important, when I read this article, it's such an important revelation, because now it kind of taps into, why am I interested in history? Why am I interested in the Masorah? Why are we learning all about it this year? Why do I want to find more biographies and more stories? Because it helps us shape our identity as trying to come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Isn't that what we're all about? And we shouldn't shy away from that. It's an opportunity for us to take it in our hands, to take it more seriously, and to think about it. And when we see somebody making a choice, instead of dismissing them and say, oh, what a flip out, to look to that and say, you know what? That person is following their path. And they may find it in a different place than we find ourselves. And they may be close relatives of ours or friends. So how that does that play out in the world of the Posek, in the world of the Gadol? I want to conclude with one quote. An amazing, awesome article. Take a look at this. We have here a Xerox copy of the New York Times. What a better way to end this year than a copy of the New York Times. Here we are, Monday, May 5th, 1975. This is actually the picture of the page that you would see in the New York Times. How often do you see this picture? Who is featured in this picture in the New York Times? That's it, Rav Moshe Feinstein. Big picture in the New York Times.
What page?
It's page 3. I got cut off. It's smudged off. I have it written down.
In the New Jersey
section of the Times. What's the article about? It's about Psak. Responsa, the law as seen by rabbis for 1,000 years. So it's an interesting article, which I could send you if you want the whole article. But what interests me is Rav Moshe's one-liner that he gave to the New York Times that is the caption of this article. What made Rav Moshe a posek? What made him a Gadol Hador? So obviously what made Rav Moshe a Gadol Hador was that the man learned Shas 500 times. But that he learned Shulchan Aruch, arguably, some people say he learned it 300 times. That he was mamish, an expert in literally Kol HaTorah Kula. The breadth and the analysis and the saintliness of Rav Moshe is just mind-boggling. But why did he think he became a gadol for people? He says, quote, if people see that one answer is good and another answer is good, gradually you'll be accepted. Rav Moshe said, people called me and they liked what I told them. So the next person called me and the next person called me. Rav Moshe said that's really what developed his following. People gravitated to Rav Moshe because of his enormity, of who he was. So in a certain sense, Rav Moshe created this following, this community. He was a gadol for the people who followed him, all those followers of his, because they recognized him as their gadol, as their leader. Obviously, he had the objective metal, the objective standards, but it was the following that developed, that Rav Moshe became who he was. So,
did he feel he was a gadol?
Yes, he knew he was a gadol. Being an anav, being humble, Rav Moshe was a ridiculous anav, does not mean being fooled into not knowing who you are. It means you know who you are and you know where it comes from. And you know your role in the world based on the way the Ribbono Shel Olam places you. Rav Moshe writes in this article, he tells them, a rabbi who replies to people's questions works harder than a doctor dealing with a case of life and death. And by the way, he dealt with both, of course. But the idea that we want to take away is, last week we said, great, there's Reb Lezer, and there's Reb Yoshua. There are lots of different pieces of the Sora. There are a lot of different strains, you could call them. Now what we're saying is that in every generation, that is essential. You must have a Chacham who is your Bala Masorah. Otherwise, you do not have a legitimate Masorah. That's not orthodox. But how does it develop? How does it come about? It's self-selection. If these Talmidim, who are faithful to their Rebbe, and that community links and connects to this Bala Masorah and are truly feel, they have a fealty, they are truly faithful to the commitment and to the standard of that posek, that chacham, that gadol, So then that is a fulfillment, and that is a continuation of the Masorah, and that is what we're striving to create for ourselves in our community, and that, I think, is why for us it's going to be important to spend time focusing on our Baalei HaMasorah and what our Masorah really is. Have a great week. Okay.
Terrific challenge this people is in Israel.
Yes.
With the rabbi.
Exactly.
Turning things that this is a model that already developed in